comes from Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad.
I am so excited for the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show because I'm speaking with one of the most respected and admired experts in the field of personal finance. Her name, Jane Bryant Quinn, and I'm sure many of you have encountered her either on television or in much of the writing she has done, including the best-selling book, Making the Most of Your Money Now, and Everyone's Money Book, among other books she's written. Her latest, which I found greatly interesting and helpful from a very personal point of view, since I am 55 years old, is called How to Make Your Money Last, The Indispensable Retirement Guide. And I am not particularly fond of such books because I know so little about this whole realm of human life, but I found this book so helpful and so accessible, and she gives up all kinds of incredibly beneficial information about really every facet of retirement, and whether you are facing retirement imminently or if it's something that's perhaps off in the future a bit, but something that you have not yet really thought about enough in terms of how to be properly prepared for it. Again, not just financially, but in other aspects as well. It's a wonderful book. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm tremendously excited to talk with its author. Jane Bryant Quinn, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg, and I'm so happy you're finding that book useful.
I really, really am. By the way, in the course of the introduction, you make mention of the fact that your own mother, not too long ago, celebrated her 100th birthday. You mention it in order to make the point that more and more Americans are living longer and longer, and that changes the dynamics of the whole matter of retirement and preparing for whenever the end of life comes. Just say a quick word about how important it is to remember this.
People 65 today, and by the way, 10,000 baby boomers a day are reaching 65 right now, are probably going to live, their life expectancy goes to their late 80s. The number of people 90 and over has tripled in three decades. And next month we will celebrate my mother's 101st, Greg.
Wow.
So she's still going. But this is one of the things that I like to really need to emphasize when you're trying to look at how long your money is going to last in retirement, is that you're going to live, odds are, a lot longer than you think. So preparing, if you can work longer, if you can put off taking Social Security, if you can build up more savings, that is going to be all to the good for you. And in figuring out how your money will last, you have to make plans for its lasting maybe 20 or 30 years. And you might think, I'll never live that long. You know, when you're 55, you know, 80 seems like a million years away. But you should actually expect to live to a later age. And when you're coming to how you bet on what choices you should make about annuities or pensions or Social Security or how much to take out of savings, I urge everybody to plan on a living longer than you thought rather than dying soon. You've got to put your money in a place where you won't outlive it if you have a very long life, and the odds are you will.
One of the sentences that I especially appreciated in your book was helpful to me because I think there are some people, when they think about their lives and they think about the end of their lives, who feel like because of who they are and what's important to them, they don't want to sort of delve into this whole realm of investment portfolios and all that, because in a sense, being wealthy has never been important to them. That they don't need a yacht, and they don't need a retirement home in Florida, and they don't need this kind of thing. That life for them is relatively simple, and so the whole notion of, you know, kind of building your personal wealth and so on. I mean, just right from the outset, it feels like it's something that somebody else needs to do. But you say at one point, it's hard to be happy if you're always worried about the bills. So people need to think about this if for no other reason than because you want to have enough money simply to exist and simply to live the life you want to, even if that's a relatively simple life without yachts and country clubs and so on. But I think that's really important. And I think often when books like this get written, they're written with what seems to be the assumption that everybody wants to be rich. Everybody wants to have as much money as they possibly can. And of course, not everybody approaches life that way. I think you're really sensible to acknowledge that variety out there, but the universality of some of these important points you're making.
Well, however much money you have, you're going to have to make it last for an undetermined number of years. And so it's important to what I call right-size your life, regardless of what level you are. If you've saved just a little, if wealth was your intention, that's one thing. But if just living comfortably the way you are is your goal, you have to see, do I have enough money to do this? A lot of people approach retirement saying, how much money will I need to retire to pay my bills? That's backwards. You say, you project your Social Security, a pension if you have one, any other sources of income, and a certain amount of money you can take out of whatever savings you have, and you say, that's going to be my income. And so then when you're looking at your expenses, you have to fit your life to the amount of income you can expect. And that might take nips and tucks, it might take downsizing, but whatever it is, once you reach that balance in retirement that says, okay, I know my basic bills are going to be covered, I've solved the question of how much I can afford to spend and live in some particular way, once you reach that balance, you know, then you start being happy in retirement. Mm-hmm. The idea is to right-size your life, live within your future retirement income, so you don't have to think about it anymore, and get on with all the more important things, like what you're going to do with the next 20 or 30 years of your life. That's a huge question. I mean, retirement is an emotional question as well as a financial question.
Right. And you say at one point, permanent vacations can get pretty boring. And if at a glance, that might seem like the ideal kind of retirement, but typically people are hungry for more meaning than that. I appreciated the fact that in the first chapter, when you talk about the retirement, that you also acknowledge the fact that people can sometimes retire under very different circumstances. Sometimes it's the seamless script that we all sort of write for ourselves, where we work in a job we love until it's time to retire, and we choose to retire, and so on. And then in other cases, retirement is thrust upon us for one reason or another. Sometimes the loss of that job, or a drastic shift in your spouse's well-being, or whatever. But no matter the circumstances under which you are retiring, there are several fundamental questions that need to be asked. And those three questions are, who are you? What are you going to do with the rest of your life? And where will you find friends? I was really surprised by that last question. That caught me a bit off guard. Tell us why you think it's important for someone facing impending retirement to think about that.
Because many of your friends are probably drawn from your workplace. And once you leave the workplace, you can, if they're still working, you can call them up and you can exchange, you know, old war stories, but that won't last very long because the office gossip moves on pretty quickly, and suddenly you are out of the loop, and they're still working the old job, and you are not. And unless you have a group of friends or develop a group of friends around a completely different interest away from the workforce, you can be quite lonely for a while. Who are you going to play cards with? Who are you going to volunteer with? Who are you going to go to a movie with? These things become very important when you are out of the workplace and you have no guaranteed group of friends and acquaintances that you see every day. My sister has just retired from a very high-intensive job, and she was struck by the same sentence you were struck by, and she realized that she hadn't had time to do much volunteering, and so she needed to take a look around and see what she wanted to do. I mean, she was young to retire. What she wanted to do, where she could see people and have lunch and have a social atmosphere. In fact, for money, when you retire, if you need extra money, a surprising number of older people are doing things like driving for Uber. And one of the reasons they say they're doing it is they meet people. They talk to people. The risk is isolation. And even if you're married, the risk is two sets of isolation. You know, you can, I love my husband, but I don't think I want to look in his eyes for, 20 hours or 15 hours a day. We have to get out and do something.
Right. I appreciated that in talking about this sort of facet of retirement, let's maybe call it sort of the softer facets. This is not the IRA, Social Security part, but just the sort of thinking about your life part of it. You ask people, first of all, to sit down and make a list, and preferably a really long list, of all the things that make you happy or have made you happy, even in the distant past, and maybe things that you've thought about doing but have never, ever done. And I so appreciated the long list of possibilities that you include in what such a list might look like, just to get people kind of thinking beyond that, a list they should make about the skills they have, what they have to offer the world. But the third thing is what I wanted to ask you specifically about. You say to get yourself moving, set up an engagement calendar, one of those month-at-a-glance hanging calendars or a calendar maybe once a day or whatever, and put something useful or interesting into your schedule every day. I love this suggestion, and I hope a lot of people will take it to heart. What prompted you to make this suggestion?
Because you need a reason to get up in the morning. And it was always there when you were working. You had to get up. You had to go to the office. And then when you stop doing that, there may be a honeymoon period where you say, oh, I'm free. Isn't this wonderful? But unless you have something that you do, that you contribute, where you feel you are being positive and useful in your life, if you're just sitting around the house and watching too much television, you are going to get depressed. And that is, in fact, a common emotional result after the first retirement, saying, oh, great, no more stress, no more pressure. And if you have not arranged or thought ahead about what you are going to do with your days, and then you can get bored with yourself, your spouse can get bored with you, and you don't know what you will do with your, and depression often results, and people gradually pull their way out of it because they get their finances straightened away and they start filling in their calendar. And it can be things as simple as errands or shopping or projects painting the porch that you meant to do for a long time. But gradually you have to get yourself into some other line of not work but volunteering, that which goes to the part of being having a social group. Or this is a great year to join a political campaign. I mean, here's another group of people you might work with, and their political, local, or national political campaigns. Put something on the calendar and get engaged in some way that will make you feel useful and happy to get up in the morning and have something to do. You know, it's 20 or 30 years. I mean, we're not just talking about a few weeks. It's a long time.
And it's an opportunity to reinvent your life. At the close of this portion of the book, as you begin then going into the more financial aspects of retirement, you make an interesting point that really struck home for me, because I happen to be in a situation where I will work for as long as I possibly can, and my wife will be retiring basically as soon as she can. And so we face kind of an interesting dilemma that you touch on, the fact that retirement in some ways is a little simpler when both members of the couple retire nearly simultaneously, versus a situation like ours where I'll probably be working 10 years past my wife's retirement. And what are the ways in which someone who faces that kind of complexity, what should they be thinking about?
Well, first, of course, they should be talking about it. I find that very often with married couples, one person has a particular future in mind for retirement and assumes that the spouse thinks the same way. After all, you know, married all these years, of course you're going to think the way I do. And then you have the sudden shock to discover, well, no, maybe not. Well, your spouse is a good example. Said, I don't want to work as long as you do. I want to retire. But now she can't just sit around and wait for you to come home. She is going to have to develop the life for herself outside of her work. And all of this kinds of things we've been talking about is going to be her job to do. And you can be supportive and encourage various things, but she's going to have to figure this out. I'll give you just talking about one small example with a friend of mine who went through this little depression we're talking about, and her husband was a doctor and he was still working and she wasn't. And she used to play the clarinet when she was in high school. And she thought about it, and she took up the clarinet again. And she took lessons, and now she is playing in a group, and they go to competitions. It took her a while to get there, but she realized that was something she always loved doing. And now she has this separate life, and she'll go off for a week to clarinet camp or something. Her husband's working, that's fine. You know, it's your job to say, this is my life and that's her life, and if she's going to be away for a week, that's very good for her. I don't expect her to be home to cook my meals.
We're speaking with Jane Bryant Quinn, and we're talking about her brand new book called How to Make Your Money Last, The Indispensable Retirement Guide. One of the key concepts, as far as you're concerned, is something called right-sizing your life. You devote the entire second chapter to this. Explain to our listeners what this concept is all about, right-sizing one's life.
It starts with projecting how much income you are likely to have from your retirement, what you can expect from Social Security, a pension if you have one, what you can realistically withdraw from any savings you have and still have it last for 30 years, and there are ways to figure that out, which I do have in my book. And you say, okay, that's my limit. That is the income I am going to have. And then you look at your expenses, and if that income will cover your expenses, great. You're in great shape, and you can go on and go out and do all these other things we've been talking about. But if there is a gap, as there usually is, the income you expect in the future in retirement is not enough to cover the way you are living now, then the sooner you get to that, the better. It might take just some nips and tucks. Almost all retirees make nips and tucks somewhere to balance out their lives. But sometimes it's something big. You say, I really can't afford this house or this mortgage anymore. I took a big mortgage into retirement. I regret it now, but I'm going to sell the house and move somewhere to a condo, downsize, do something cheaper. Whatever it is, you have to, and this is the right size of your life, make your style of living fit the income you are going to have so you don't worry about money all the time.
Right. And you say once you've achieved whatever that balance might be, emotionally as well as material, you will find yourself at peace. You will know that you can afford your life. That is a concept that I like very much. You spend a great deal of time, of course, as anybody would who's writing on this topic, talking about Social Security. which you love. You say, I love Social Security. It's America's finest retirement plan. But you say that so many Americans misunderstand Social Security and actually are allowing much of what they should have coming go to waste. What are probably a couple of the most important ways in which too many Americans kind of misunderstand or misuse Social Security?
One is taking Social Security as soon as they are eligible for it, which is 62, even if they don't really, really need the money. They take it because they say, well, if I don't take it and I wait 5 years and then something happens and I die, well, I will have been rooked. I paid all those taxes and I didn't get Social Security. But this is assuming, making a life plan, assuming you are going to die young. And I tell everybody, make a life plan assuming that you are going to live until your late 80s plus. And in that case, what you should do is delay Social Security for as long as possible. If you delay till 70, between 62 and 70, if you delay that long a time, your check at 70 will be 76% higher than it would have been at 62 plus any inflation adjustments. And if you have a long life, this is your longevity insurance because it's inflation adjusted every year. And if you die with a higher benefit, you will leave more money to a surviving spouse if the spouse is dependent on you. And so the two of you are involved in this Social Security decision. And so putting it off is the main thing. There are, for people who were 62 last year, there are all, and if you and your spouse both have earning records, there are still ways that you can do a claiming strategy where you can get an extra benefit, a spouse benefit and a retirement benefit. But that's, Congress made changes last year, and so this is available only to people who were 62 and up last year. But if you qualify for putting your claiming strategies together that way, synchronizing them, you should absolutely do it because that will raise the amount of money you'll get.
Very good. You mentioned, too, that the Social Security Handbook has over 2,700 separate rules. So you need to be careful about the people that you get advice from about Social Security, and if you call Social Security themselves, maybe call more than one person.
Oh, and by the way, Greg, if I can just interject here, these new rules are not yet on the Social Security website. So when and the Social Security, the local offices in particular, are very uneducated on these new rules. And if you were 62 and up last year and were eligible for having both a spouse benefit and your own benefit, which increases the income that you would get over your lifetime, they might say, no, that isn't true anymore. Well, it isn't true for people who are younger, but it is still true for people who were 62 and up last year. People are getting wrong answers. And when they go to Social Security's website, the right answers are still not there. And I spoke with someone at Social Security just yesterday saying, when is it coming up? And they say, well, it's the legal team. We have to be very careful how the new rules work. And they're right on that. But you just need to know that you are not going to be able to find good information on the Social Security website about this.
Mm. Your book goes on to, of course, explore pensions, health insurance, annuities, retirement savings plans, and so on. Could you say a quick word about the concept of bucketing? Because you'd spend a lot of time talking about this.
Bucketing is one of the ways I mentally manage my money. When you think about what you want your savings to do, you have a cash bucket, and there's enough cash, should be enough cash in that bucket to be sure that you will cover all of your expenses for the next 2 years, with your Social Security, with any other source of income, plus taking money out of your cash budget. So you're safe for at least 2 years, no matter what the stock market does, if you're invested in stock market mutual funds. But and then the rest of your money can be, as an investor, can be divided between stock-owning mutual funds and bond funds. And so it's a stock bucket and a bond bucket. The bond bucket can basically keep you secure for the next 5 or 7 years, so you're really in good shape. And then your stock bucket is there to grow your money for the future, because you're going to live a long time and you're going to want to your money to grow. And over 10-15 year periods, the stock market always comes back, it always goes higher. So when you're saying, what am I going to live on 15, 20 years from now, that will be the amount of money that you are keeping in broadly based stock-owning index funds. Not individual stocks, because I don't know what individual stocks are going to do, and neither do you.
Right.
But if you have that kind of money in a broad-based stock-owning mutual fund, you are securing the second half of your retirement. So that's your stock bucket, and then your bond bucket is for the first part of your retirement.
I like how you say at one point, stocks are the growth in your portfolio, bonds are the ballast. I wanted to mention real quick, I know we have to let you go, but I appreciated that early in the book you talked about how you've changed your mind about a few things through the course of writing this book. And I you know, for someone who is as great an expert as you are, I appreciated the fact that you were honest about that, that the world changes, that you change, and that your perspective continues to change on some of these matters.
And products change. One of the things I changed my mind about was the individual annuity. Now, these are not the high-cost, deferred, variable, blah, blah, blah annuities that financial advisors like to sell you, because they get 5 to 7% commissions on them, and you pay 3.5% a year costs, and they're just not going to do what you think they should do. I'm still against those annuities. But I have a new appreciation of what you call the immediate annuity, which is you put up some money, and this is a low-cost product. You put up some money. The insurance company says, fine, we'll pay you X dollars a year for life. And if you are someone who has, you think that your money is going to last you for 30 years, you're not absolutely sure, but you've tried it for 5 years, 7 years or so, and you're getting a little more worried about it, if you take some money out of your bond bucket, your bond mutual fund, and you shift that money into an immediate pay annuity, you will instantly get a higher monthly income, because the annuity will pay you more than the bond is paying you, more than you can prudently take out of the bond fund. It's a very simple shift, and it's a way of extending, improving your monthly income for the rest of your life.
Well, that and much more wonderful information is just packed into this terrific book called How to Make Your Money Last, The Indispensable Retirement Guide. A very, very readable, accessible book, and just helpful from start to finish, published by Simon & Schuster. Jane Bryant-Quinn, thank you for writing such a fine book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Best wishes to you.
And best wishes to you, Greg, and to everyone listening.
Well, it may seem a little strange in this season of Valentine's Day to be talking about divorce. And yet, it is a reality that, of course, is a part of many, many people's lives. And in many cases, divorce comes very unexpectedly, a very unwanted intruder, in a sense, into someone's marriage. But sometimes that's just simply what has to happen. Maybe it's a marriage that just never should have occurred in the first place, or maybe a marriage that for one reason or another has just, in a sense, gone sour to the point where the marriage cannot and perhaps even should not be preserved. At any rate, all kinds of people find themselves confronted by the reality, perhaps the necessity, of divorce. A recent book shines a light on some of the most important matters to consider and explore if the reality of divorce becomes a part of your life. It's a book called Divorce Demystified. And It is written by an attorney by the name of Henry S. Gornbein, who has been active in family law for many, many years, practicing in Michigan for more than four decades, and has written extensively on various topics related to divorce. A contributor and blogger for the Huffington Post, he has also produced podcasts for DivorceSourceRadio.com. And he's been sought out by all kinds of different media outlets to offer up his expertise on the topic. Again, this book is called Divorce Demystified, published by Momentum Books. And Henry S. Gornbein, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, thank you so much.
One of the things you say right off the bat in your introduction is, although divorce typically is quite a traumatic experience, it can be very painful, but divorce can be a good thing. And I suppose you've been doing this long enough to realize the reality of that, that there are those cases where two people never should have been married, or those cases where a marriage has gone so sour that it really is the best of all alternatives. How would you help people sort out that matter, that really crucial matter of whether or not divorce is the thing that needs to occur?
Well, the first thing I discussed was therapy. Second thing is, don't rush into it. There's nothing urgent about filing for divorce. Think it through. Make sure this is what you want. I mean, there's an old saying, be careful what you wish for. And the other thing is, what is the reason that you're getting a divorce? I mean, people get just like people get married because they're in love, but they get married for almost any reason under the sun. They get divorced for almost any reason under the sun. And there's a big change going on now, and that is the impact of the Internet and social media. And I write about this in my book, the fact that when I wrote the book, social media, such as Facebook and other sites, with Facebook being the major one, triggered or was a major factor in 20% of all divorces. Greg, as we speak today, the figure is up to a third of all divorces. So the impact of social media is huge. And why is this? Think about the fact that if someone wanted to stray, of course they could, and of course they did. But they would meet perhaps in a bar, perhaps around an office water cooler or a coffee break, and things would occur in a very gradual fashion. Now, to me, the Internet, it's like everything on steroids. You press a button, and you can be anywhere you want to be. You can be whoever you want to be. You can meet anyone, both for whatever purposes under the sun. I mean, this past summer, we had the huge scandal with the fact that Ashley Madison, which is a site that says life is short, have an affair, had millions of people, and all of a sudden, they were hacked. And I had someone come to me about a divorce whose husband confessed the fact that he was on Ashley Madison. So, you know, you have these things. You have the fact that on the Internet you can meet anyone very, very easily. It's very easy not to be yourself. I've had cases where people were caught up in scams on the Internet. There's something called the Nigerian scam, which is where someone poses to be a lover, often in another country, and then, you know, the relationship develops. Again, there's no face-to-face meeting, but everything's done on the Internet, perhaps phone calls if it goes that far. And I had a case where I had a woman who flew to England, and she was planning to move in with her lover, and it turned out to be a scam, and she spent many, many thousands of dollars being taken. So these things happen. The other thing is, one of the biggest things on the Internet is pornography. If we were talking years ago, yeah, it's out there, but you go to a movie theater or you go to an adult bookstore, now you press a button and it's everywhere. Similarly, gambling is huge online. And we've had these issues in the last few months over fantasy football and the fact that these have become billion-dollar money makers for people, but huge losers for people who are betting. So it's a form of legalized betting, but it's on the Internet. people day trade. I've had people who lose fortunes in the stock market by playing every day on the stock market. I've had people who've been addicted to buying, shopping, shopaholics, or people who just sit on the internet all day. One of the things that's become a bigger and bigger issue is the fact that people can't get away from their screens. I mean, my wife will yell at me because I'll come home and I'll be taking emails, or, you know, it's there. It's addictive. And what I tell people, in fact, we were talking earlier about Valentine's Day, and I wrote a blog that's coming out on a site for Divorce Magazine about how to have a healthy marriage and how to, you know, create a good relationship. And one of the things I say is have downtown. Put away those screens when you're home. You know, interact with your wife, your husband, and children. So these are important things. And one of the reasons, as I'm saying, the internet is a huge source of it for the demise of marriages. Other things on the internet are the fact that people can be addicted to games. I had a case where a teenage boy was addicted to games on the internet. He dropped out of school, literally had to go into intensive therapy at a inpatient facility. And this is more common than people believe. You can access almost any drug you want. There was an internet site called the Silk Road, which was put out of business as being illegal, with the founders, who were really basically drug lords, going to jail. You have other sites that I've had impacted in my cases called revenge porn sites, where these are places where perhaps a jilted husband or wife or jilted lover will suddenly post intimate pictures on the internet or say things on the internet. And during this past calendar year in 2015, there were criminal charges and arrests and I think incarceration for people involved in some of these revenge porn sites, and now there are laws against them. So the internet, Greg, has a huge impact on divorce.
In other words, it has made possible all kinds of behaviors that can be terribly detrimental to a given marriage.
It makes it easier. It's always been possible. Now it's a lot easier.
Right. We're talking with Henry Gornbein, whose book is called Divorce Demystified. At one point you say divorce is not simple. It is not one size fits all. In some respects, divorce is a simple thing in that with a divorce you end a marriage, but they come in a number of different sort of there are different ways in which people divorce, and in particular, you say that there are in some respects several different divorces which occur simultaneously in one divorce: the legal, the psychological, the economic, and the religious. One or more of all of those kinds of divorces will be wrapped up, in a sense, in one legal transaction. Why do you think it's important to take apart divorce in this way? I mean, how is it helpful for somebody experiencing divorce to make these distinctions?
I think it's important because part of the underlying purpose of my book was to demystify. Take the example of the Wizard of Oz, where you find the wizard cloak behind the screen, and you find out he's really not a wizard and it's a sham. Well, the legal system is very complicated, it's very frightening, and divorce is traumatic. One thing I've learned over the years that as far as life-altering things, the worst thing that can happen is, of course, the death of a child. Second is the death of a spouse in an intact marriage, and third is a divorce. So when I was writing the book, I thought about the fact that there are components. So the first one, as you said, Greg, is there's a legal divorce. And this is where a judge signs a final decree and pronounces a couple divorced. It used to be husband and wife. Now, since the Supreme Court ruled, it can be husband and husband or wife and wife. So these are all things that are out there. So that's a legal divorce. Second is a psychological divorce. And for anyone specializing in family law, this is an important component. Because what I've learned over the years is the reason that divorces can be very difficult is because one or the other may not be ready to let go. And if you have a couple who've agreed, yeah, we're not going anywhere, the marriage is not working, let's separate, let's end it. And they're both on the same page psychologically. You have a simple divorce. But if one or the other spouse, either because of anger or because of emotional problems, can't let go, that's where you have the fireworks. These are the cases where couples are in court sometimes every week, sometimes every month, and you have a more complicated divorce, and you're spending more money on attorney fees. The worst case psychologically is what I call the never-ending divorce. And these are the cases that the judges hate, the attorneys hate, because they go on year after year after year. Long after the divorce has been legally finalized, people will find things to fight about. There'll be custody and parenting time battles that go on until the children reach the age of 18. They'll be fighting over child support. They can be fighting over issues over property. And it goes on and on and on. And this is because one or the other spouse is either so angry, so bitter, or so emotionally unhinged that they can't let go. And this is where hundreds and hundreds of thousands of attorney fees are spent. The children's lives can be ruined. I mean, I've had cases, and this is another phase, is where you get something called parental alienation, where one parent is trying to turn the children against the other parent. And it exists. I see it in cases, and it's horrible. And what parties are doing, because of their anger or bitterness or emotional problems, psychologically, all they're doing is destroying their children. So there's the psychological divorce, which is a critical piece of the puzzle. Third, there's an economic divorce, because economically, the reality is no one's happy. At the beginning of divorce, you say you need an attorney, and the attorney is there, and after the divorce, you have half of what you had before. You're dividing property. Normally, it's 50-50. You're dividing debts. Sometimes one party has more of the debts than the other. Then you have support issues. There's child support. There could be alimony, spousal support issues. So everyone walks away with their pockets half full, so to speak, and with obligations. And often, especially with spousal support, you're paying for a dead horse. You're paying for a vacation that happened 10 years ago, and no one likes it. So these are issues. So that's why there's an economic divorce. Finally, in three major religions, there's a religious aspect to divorce. In Judaism, you have a get, which is controlled by the male. And there have been some cases where a husband will refuse to grant the religious divorce. And in Judaism, in conservative, especially in Orthodox branches, the woman cannot remarry without the get. And the man controls it. So that's an issue. Similarly, in the Islamic faith, you have a right that's similar to the get, and the man controls it. And we have a case right now which is very interesting in our office, where a woman came to us who had been married for 12 or 13 years with three children. She was Islamic. Her husband was Islamic. They'd had an Islamic marriage. She files for divorce because her husband was abusive and was controlling the money and basically mistreating her and the children. And there had been some pretty severe physical and psychological abuse. What happened was, when she filed, her husband's attorney then counterfiled and moved to have the case thrown out, because while they had had an Islamic divorce, unbeknownst to her, he had never filed a legal civil marriage. So they were married Islamically, but not civilly. So the case was tossed out of court, other than the fact that they were fighting over custody and support issues. So when she came, she was referred to us by her divorce attorney, who didn't know what to do, and we said, well, this man has a lot of businesses. They were married legally Islamically. While they're not married legally under the civil laws, clearly you have a case for abuse, fraud, unjust enrichment. The man drove around in a $100,000 car. He had several businesses. There's a lot of money there. So we are filing suit for fraud and unjust enrichment civilly. So again, there are things that can be done. And the religious aspects is important. Finally, Greg, in Catholicism, if you want to remarry within the Catholic Church, you have to enter an annulment. So it's not a divorce, there's an annulment required through the Archdiocese of the Church, and there are certain guidelines. Now, what's interesting, no other major religion touches on divorce at all. So these are some of the things that are in my book that are probably different than any other book that's written. So
in one of the chapters, you give us a long list of things that people should think about doing before you file for divorce. And this is once you've chosen an attorney, and that in and of itself is kind of an interesting challenge. And you give some suggestions on things people should think about as they are choosing who will be just the right attorney or the right law firm to engage for this matter. When it comes to before you're filing a divorce, you have a long list of suggestions. One of them is keep a diary. Tell us the main purpose of someone keeping a diary or journal as they are experiencing this.
Okay, well, what's interesting, my daughter and I did a book called Divorce Write, W-R-I-T-E, which we've never really marketed, but part of that is incorporated with the diary in this book. And the whole idea of keeping a diary is severalfold. Number one, a divorce is a process. And you may file for divorce in 1 month, and the divorce could take 6 months, it could take a year, depending on what state you're in, sometimes even longer. In Michigan, every divorce has to be finished within 1 year. In Wisconsin, there might be more different rules, but every state has their own sets of rules. And if you ask my wife, I don't remember what happened yesterday or last week, much less 6 months or 9 months ago. So the reason for keeping a diary is severalfold. Number one, it's cathartic because you're writing down things and you're getting things off your chest. Number two, rather than calling or writing your attorney every day, by writing these things down, the client and the attorney at certain key points will discuss the things in the diary. And so you're saving money. Number three, as events occur, you're writing things down contemporaneously. And as an attorney, when I'm either preparing for settlement meetings, for perhaps a hearing or trial, or even mediation or arbitration, which are key steps in the process of trying to resolve a divorce, this diary is a very useful tool because we have laid out key events that have happened during the time from the beginning of the divorce through the time that we are preparing for a hearing or trial. So rather than having to recreate everything, it's there at our fingertips. And this is why a diary is so important. And this is another key aspect of the divorce that probably differentiates this book from any other book.
Hmm. Cool. The book, again, is called Divorce Demystified. It's published by Momentum Books and the author, Henry Gornbein. Henry Gornbein, I appreciate you joining me today on the morning show. I think this is a very, very important topic that you very thoroughly explore in your book, and I appreciate you joining me today on the morning show to talk about it. Best wishes,
Greg,
to you.
I appreciate you having me as a guest, and I thank you very much.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha, online at andreasgifts.com. It is 8:59 precisely. Coming up at 9 o'clock, we will join Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming. Between now and then, we can check the weather forecast for you from the National Weather Service. For today, Wednesday the 17th, sunny and seasonal. Today's high 29. Some perspective on that number. Normal high this time of year, 33, so we're close. The record high for this date was 55 degrees, February the 17th, 1981. Tonight, partly cloudy, a low of 16. Thursday, cloudy, windy, and mild with a high of 39. Friday, cloudy for the morning, sunny for the afternoon, 20% chance of rain. Friday's high, 55. 49 on Saturday, 43 on Sunday. Right now, sunny, 19 degrees we're seeing in Kenosha, 15 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.